All right, we're in C++ world again. Louis Lafreniere. Is that how you say it?
Yes, that's right pretty
on.
Close.
You haven't been on here for... You've been on here twice.
Yeah.
And so you've been doing some rocket science again. What's going on?
Well, the latest thing is GS++, which is an extension to... continuation to improving GS. GS started a long time ago, I think in the late 90s, is when we started working on that for VisualStudio.net. Mm-hmm. And we started working on GS at beginning to for IE. IE was having a lot of security issues, and all of their security issues were with parsing. So strings was the big thing we were trying to protect. Mm. So the first GS was really targeted at protecting strings against buffer overruns.
Okay.
And we've done a lot of improvements to how GS worked, but one of the things we never changed was the kind of like the string focus. Mm. So the only things that GS was protecting were arrays that were of element size 1 or 2 bytes. And, I mean, that's an issue we kind of knew for a long time, but and we wanted to extend that, but the downside of it was the perf impact that this might have.
Okay.
And trying to do the change and then proving that the perf impact is okay is always quite a bit of work. So I think that's why it took a long time for us to get to the point where we finally did it. Okay. But now we did.
Excellent.
So we actually have the SWI team help us, the Secure Windows Initiative people. There's a guy in the UK, Tim Burrell, who helped us with that.
Okay.
He kind of took the initiative to drive it and drive measuring the perf on Windows and SQL to make sure that the perf were acceptable. And so the main thing was to expand the scope to cover more than just string buffers, but to cover any kind of buffers, as well as structs. There was one exploit that happened not too long ago. It was the AnyCursor exploit. There was a patch for that went out, and it was like kind of one of the fairly critical one.
Okay.
And it was a struct that was being overrun.
Interesting.
So it was not a buffer by the sense of a buffer. So that kind of was a big driver also for us to do this work. Mm. But we didn't want to protect all buffers and all structs, because this would have a big impact. It means every frame practically would have a GS cookie on it, and we'd have to initialize the cookie and check the cookie, and we also reorganize the stack when we're doing GS, so that has some perf implication. Mm-hmm. So we tried to figure out some heuristics to minimize the overhead and try to detect things that didn't need to be protected.
So let me ask you a question, because mm-hmm. I mean, it's really interesting that you mentioned that, you know, the notion of struct overflow. In some sense, it's all about memory management.
Right.
It's all about safe memory safety anyway.
Exactly.
So structs get allocated on the stack,
right?
And
or on the heap.
But there's...
Stack ones are the ones we're
that's
talking
where,
about
that's
here.
That's the problem. Fair enough. So let's talk a little bit about the kind of the semantics of how this can be exploited without telling people how to exploit things.
Well, it'd be... I mean, file formats are often... the case for those where you have a file format that has a size prefix followed by the data, and if the code that's reading this is expecting a certain format for the data, but the size is kind of lying and it exceeds the thing that's supposed to fit in, that's the kind of places that you have problems.
Sure.
So, I mean, this more typically arrays that you'll see overflowing.
Yeah.
But as we saw, it can happen with structs as well.
Interesting.
I think it's probably more rare, but it can happen.
So WACGFs, for people who don't, mm-hmm. who might not remember, or people who, you know, let's be honest, aren't writing C++,
yes.
is a compiler switch.
Yep.
And rather than, I guess we could talk about, you know, what actually happens
what GS does.
When you use that compiler switch, and then if you want to do that, or we can just talk about what GS++ does.
Yeah, no, we can start by talking about GS and and going in the details of that one.
It's always fun getting you on the whiteboard, man.
Sure.
That's how I'm trying to get this going.
Yeah.
Get Lewis on the whiteboard.
All right, I'm just going to pop this up. You got some nice Ship It awards there, buddy. So you've been at the company for a while. I remember
18
last
years.
Time. 18?
Yeah.
Wow. Can I borrow some money, bro?
I'm just kidding. Right on. So let's check this out.
So so typically, if we have a function that takes puts a space there, let's put a char star p. Let's say we have another char star q, and we have char buff, it's 100 bytes. 100 should be big enough, right?
Yeah, I hope so.
And we're calling function bar, and we pass it buff. And bar decides to write 1,000 bytes to buff, which will overflow the stack.
Could you mind using glue instead, just because it's hard for the people to see?
No problem.
But we can see this now. Okay, got that.
So a normal stack frame would look like we would first push P on the stack, then we would push the return address for F. And then we would put the local variables. Typically, we'll put the smaller locals first, because then they'll be closer to the base of the stack. And if we have an EBP frame in particular, you have a smaller encoding if you can encode the offset in a byte.
Okay.
So typically, Q would end up right here. And then you'd have buff right here. And then the stuff for bar. So the addresses on the stack going this direction. So if you overflow, you'll start writing over this data. The first obvious one is the return address. That's the used to be the most common way to have buffer overflow exploit, is to overrun the return address. You come back from bar, you return from the function F, and the program is going to load this address and jump to it. And of course, you can point that address to this buffer, well, to the bottom, and you can have actually instructions in here, and also you're executing the instruction that somebody put in that buffer, somebody else's code. Yeah. So, but there's other things you can do. Say we have a way to prevent the return address from being overrun. Well, you can just overrun this pointer here, and if we had in the program after a star of q equals some number that the user is able to control, all of a sudden you can override q, and then you can write this value anywhere it wants in memory. So you can pick another return address somewhere else on the frame, or a function pointer, or something like that. So, and we have p also that's here on the stack, that you could do the same thing with. So with GS, the first thing that we do is that we add something on the frame. So let's redraw a new frame, a GS frame. And let's see, we have buff here. And our return address with P. So with GS, we would put a cookie in here. That cookie is a random number that's generated at load time. And whenever you you load your function, you get a different value. So if you try to exploit it and you crash a program and you restart it, you get a different value. So it's hard to guess what this value would be. So this value is put on the frame when you enter the function. And right before we're going to go and load the return address at the end of the function, we're going to check to make sure that that cookie value didn't change. So a buffer overrun that goes, tries to change the value of red, would have to change the value of cookie.
Understood.
For Q, what we do is we reorder the stack and we put Q below the buffers. Mm. Now, P is a little bit more of a problem because we don't put P there. It's the caller of the function that puts P there. But what we do is we create a copy of P, call it P prime, and we allocate it, we copy it there, and we use that version of P instead of that version of P. Mm. So if you overrun that one, it's okay, we're not going to use it anymore.
Interesting. Okay.
So that's the basic of JS. There's some other things, like we XOR actually the cookie with the stack pointer to make it harder to try to guess the cookie, and exception frames have also a cookie to prevent corruption of the exception frames.
Now, have there been any cases? I mean, there's a lot of smart hackers out there. Have there been any cases where JS is beaten?
Let me think. I mean, there's been certainly the initial JS had a lot of failures, and people found ways around it, so it kind of like made it better and better and better. But right now, I mean, there's the cases where we didn't put a cookie because we didn't think like a struct could be overflowed.
Absolutely.
Fair enough. So I can't think of people getting around. I mean, there are certainly cases that we can't protect. For example, if you put a C++ object here that has a vtable pointer, well, we're not allowed, according to the standard, to just copy the object on the stack without calling a copy constructor. So we can't just move it down. There's also the you might have some objects on the previous frame that you can overrun and exploit before we actually return and read the cookie.
Okay.
So the JS is not a bulletproof solution. It's there to kind of like, hopefully it makes it that it blocks all the exploitable avenues, but we can't guarantee that.
Certainly.
So for JS++, the main thing is to cover a bigger scope of what these buffers that we think are vulnerable are. And the main idea to try to limit the scope a little bit was to only limit it to buffers or struct that didn't have pointers in them. And the idea there is that the exploitable buffers are ones that you're copying data from the users. So either like you're reading from the keyboard, or you're reading from a file, or you're reading from the network. And in these cases, you don't read pointers. So you don't read a mix of pointers and data. So you have a big stream of data that's coming. So by looking at the fields of a struct or the element of a buffer, we can target to only the ones that contain big stream of data. And focus on those. And if there's pointers in there, you're not going to be doing a memcopy from something from a file or from network or something like that.
Certainly.
So that kind of really helped limit the scope of objects that we had to worry about while covering all those that we think are important.
Mm-hmm. But you just said something interesting. I mean, that we think is important because you guys didn't think structs were important in GS time zone. But in the ZS time frame. Chances are, who knows? Maybe you missed another.
There might be a GS++ version coming down the line.
GS sharp.
That's right.
Okay.
So that was kind of the main idea to kind of extend the scope while keeping it somewhat restricted. And focus on the. I think the main idea is that there's different levels of things that we think are dangerous. I think the strings are by far the most dangerous thing that have been exploited the most often. Next to that would then be arrays of ints or other data that are not strings. Right after that would be structs that have only data in them. And afterwards, you go into the other structs that might have pointers or other objects that you pass the address around, and somebody might be doing an mcopy and not being careful with the size. So it certainly doesn't cover everything.
Sure.
But it's trying to find a right balance between protection versus perf.
Yeah.
Good point. So, and from what we've seen, the perf impact was quite acceptable. And then we added something else to actually mitigate the perf impact even further. We added an optimization in the compiler to try to prove that, so we have a struct that's one that falls into one of that class of struct that now we decided to protect. Mm. But if we can look in the compiler at all the writes that are being done to that struct, we can prove in a lot of cases that none of those writes can actually cause an overflow. Mm. And if we can do that, we don't have to protect that that frame with a JS cookie.
Interesting.
So the optimization will look for, yeah, say we have...
Now, did that come out of MSR?
No, actually, that...
That came out of Lewis.
That came out of me.
Right on, buddy. Right on.
Jar, well, actually, let's just do void f. And let's say we have a jar buff. And we're calling bar with buff and 100. And so let's say we're doing a mem copy to p of some other thing, and we're copying I bytes. So the optimization is actually doing this interprocedurally.
Okay.
So if you use linked-time cogen, it will be more powerful and be able to catch more things. But let's say we had buff 10 equals 1. So it will look in the current function and say, okay, I have a write to buff here. It's writing to offset 10. Is this within the bounds of the buffer? Yes, it is. This write is safe. Mm. So it tries to prove every single write to that object to make sure they're all safe. In this case here, it says, oh, we're passing buff to bar. Then it would say, well, do I have any information about bar? So when we compile bar, we look and we're like, oh, we have a pointer that's being passed as parameter. Let's assume that this pointer might be pointing to, somebody might be interested in knowing the whether this is a buffer that's GS safe or not. Mm. So we're going to collect info about this pointer. And here we have a write to that pointer, and we know that we're writing I byte, which I was a parameter. It could be 100 also would catch this. This case, it would say that, oh, if we had 100, it would say, okay, this function writes 100 bytes to parameter P. In this case, it's I, so it says, well, this function is writing to the first parameter, and it's writing the number of parameter that's passed in parameter 2. So when we get here, we know that this is writing 100 bytes to buff, and this is safe. Mm. So there's no more writes to buff, so we can actually get rid of the GS check for this function.
Excellent. Now, of course, in the case where the function is written such that what you pass to it is going to be perhaps dynamically generated in the sense that maybe it's user input.
Right.
And then you have a harder time, you know, from a static analysis point of view.
Right. Certainly, if it's dynamic input, we can't prove it, and we don't want to prove it because we want to leave the check there.
Of course. But, I mean, that's just the, right, the obvious kind of example,
yes,
where you leave the check in.
And there's also a bunch of, we can certainly do better. The optimization is fairly static right now, and it's not integrated with the optimizer yet. For example, if I had the case that it doesn't catch, that I would like to catch, but doesn't yet. So I equals 0, I smaller than 10, I plus plus, it doesn't track loops. Mm. So if we had buff of I equals I, it wouldn't know what to do with this because we don't actually handle loops in this code.
Interesting.
And it wouldn't know that it would say buff I, I don't know the value of I. I have to assume this is unsafe, and it would stay. So there's room for improvement in this optimization. It's kind of something, GS++ kind of came in late, and this kind of came in late in the in a product cycle, so I just wanted to... And the thing is, with C++, there's a lot of small objects that are often created on the frame because of copy constructors, especially code that passes small objects by value. The good thing is those small objects are the ones that are really easy to prove with this optimization. Mm. In particular, we had one benchmark that was C++ code, and we saw that it was a lot of GS cookies that were being added for a big percentage of the functions in the benchmark, and this optimization got rid of 52% of the cookies that were there total.
Nice.
So it did really well in that one.
Absolutely.
Typical C code, it kind of gets rid of like 10 to 15% of the cookies. Mm. But on C++, it hits a lot.
Interesting. But I mean, in some sense, depending upon, if we take this up back into the sort of the compositional frame, mm-hmm. which is the developer composing text in their favorite editor, they can, of course, design stuff themselves in a more intelligent way and think about checking for what's being passed back in from memory.
Yes.
And further, there's also that. So if you add, like, the Ron Howard approach to writing safe code, which is writing safe code, and it's not Ron Howard. Sorry, dude. Michael Howard, you know who you are.
Right.
Ron Howard's a director. But anyway, very cool. I mean, now what about like in the sense of like a safe mem copy method in the library? Do you guys have that in the works, or does that make sense?
Well, we do actually have that already. That's shipped with was it Whidbey, I think?
Ah, great.
All right. So it's the safe CRT.
Yes.
So we have a mem copy _S.
Cool.
And actually, we have most of the CRT functions, stir copy and things like that were common for having security problems, have an _S parameter, and they take an extra parameter such that you explicitly have to pass the size of the buffers.
Totally.
And in some ways, it prevents mistakes. And in some other condition, it kind of like forces the programmer to actually make sure that you pass the size of your buffer to your function such that you can then call the right API that assumes the right size. So I think it's good to have have the extra checks in your code. It also kind of forces you to have better development practices.
Amen. So. And the sad thing is, I actually did that interview with it was your old boss. Maybe not, but
no, I think was it Allie or Martin Lovell?
Yes.
Allie.
Yeah,
okay.
Of course. And so, you know, what can I say? I've been, you know, the last 6-7 months I've been focusing on, like, the CLR.
Huh.
So I haven't been in C++ world enough, but I'm getting back.
Might have been thinking, yeah, Allie is because the last interview we had done was the exception handler.
Absolutely.
It was Allie and I.
That was an awesome interview, by the way. People love that. I mean, exceptions are interesting animals.
Yes.
And we still have a lot of work to do in that area.
Yep.
Definitely in CLR world.
Those are certainly both of those exception handling and security. There's a lot of room for making things better. I mean, there's a lot of other things the compiler can do to make things more secure, and we're trying to figure out which ones to pick and which ones make the most sense to do. And
absolutely, I mean, in some sense, it's such a hard job for you as a kind of the native compiler.
Mm-hmm.
Because the very tool in and of itself, native code, is designed up front to give maximum control to developers to actually, let's not make a mistake, the main problem is memory.
Right.
Right? The main problem is allowing people to play with memory, to allocate and deallocate and screw things up and double free and all the things that happen. So that's the power of C in native general.
And that's also
the downfall.
The downfall, and then to expect that a compiler is going to be able to automatically figure out what you're really trying to do, I mean, that's sort of science fiction. You guys are doing amazing work.
Yeah.
But at some point, the devs need to stop writing buffer overrun. And they need to design their code better, and in some sense, use C++ when you need it. Use something else when you don't.
Right.
You can write a UI on top of a core system, and you can use memory-controlled code, or another way to say it is garbage-collected code, managed code. Use managed code, man.
Yep.
Of course, there's a deployment issue.
Yep.
But that's another thing. But no, I mean, you guys do rocket science in the compiler world. Everybody uses your compiler at Microsoft, right?
Yeah.
And that's just how it works.
Yeah.
So I think people understand GSS, I mean, again, or G++, in the sense that you guys are just adding cookies to more data structures.
Right. And adding less in some cases.
Perfect. So instead of just like firebombing.
It's kind of like adding more and being smarter at the same time, trying to not being too carpet bomb everything.
Mm.
So because I mean, people use C++ for perf also.
Amen.
One of the big reason people use C++, and probably if we had done this a few years ago, people would have been saying, "Oh no, this is going to be too expensive, my code." But the landscape has changed, and security is very important now.
Mm.
And at the same time, I think the perf impact. It's actually been quite negligible with this. Mm. I mean, with the combination of the heuristics that we have and the optimizations that we haven't really measured a real perf impact.
Mm. Good, because that's always going to be the first complaint, right?
Right, exactly.
But in the end, people have to understand every single security disaster that we've dealt with as an industry is 100% blamed on C and C++,
yes.
Period.
Yes.
And, it's not because they're bad languages, but, arguably, they really aren't that, they shouldn't, it's unfortunate that they're so general purpose, because people adopt it and everyone's using it, and
just
they're
more
dangerous.
Shoot yourself in the foot.
Amen. So, I'm really starting to become a big fan of the CLR, but I mean, I love the fact that you need to have a systems language,
right,
period.
Right.
I mean, the CLR is written in C and C++, right?
It is.
So they compile with WACGS, I would imagine.
Oh, yes.
I would hope.
Everybody at Microsoft does.
Yeah, right on, dude. So are there any things like over the past, since WIDBI and earlier that kind of surprised you besides the struct thing, the fact that people were exploiting it? But what about other types of overflows?
I mean, integer overflow was kind of one of the big ones that people a few years back were like, oh, integer overflow is the next big thing.
I remember reading about
that. And I mean, there are exploits to integer overflow, but are kind of centralized around allocation.
Mm.
So I think if we're going to do something in the future, it's kind of like just kind of learning where the overflows are happening kind of makes it that we can have a more targeted approach to try to do something in compiler to prevent this problem.
Mm.
So I think that was interesting.
Absolutely.
Security wise, it just takes a while to because we will do something in compiler, and then we need to wait for the developers to pick up the new compiler and have the new feature, and then they ship their code, and then the users have to upgrade their app. So by the time we put something in compiler until it sits on somebody's machine, there's a big gap.
Mm-hmm.
So it takes a while sometimes to learn these things.
Absolutely. And then, of course, the hackers start coming.
Yes.
Right? Because that's what they want
to
do.
But they're still exploiting the old stuff.
Yes, exactly. Oh, man.
Right.
Don't plug your computer into the network. I'm just kidding. Really, really interesting stuff.
Yep.
And it's amazing to me, though, that just adding a cookie essentially would create any sort of significant performance. I mean, depending upon what your algorithm does.
Right. Well, it's there's a few things. I mean, there's the cookie that we need to initialize, move to the stack, and we do the XOR with the ESP. Then before we return, we have to check its value. So that there's a little bit of an impact. And then we have to XOR ESP again to get the original cookie value. There's the fact that we're copying the parameters down on the stack. So that copy has a cost. Very often that cost kind of goes away because we'll in-register the parameter anyway, so that the cost of the copy can go away if we can keep the parameter in the register. Mm. But then there's the cost also to reorder the stack, which makes it now that since buff is typically fairly big, that a little optimization I was talking about makes it that very often if we're using an EBP frame, we have a long offset to get to these things, and the encoding is going to be bigger for those instructions.
Okay.
So bigger code, more cache misses, blah, 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 blah. So, I mean, there's quite a few things that have a negative perf impact, but it turned out that it hasn't been that bad. So we were a little afraid, and I think it turns out that we're happily surprised that we didn't measure much. Actually, when we did the perf test on NT, a lot of the things sped up.
Nice.
We haven't quite figured out how that can be possible, but...
Well, you know, I mean, Landy Wang probably has done some rocket science in his memory manager.
Right.
And he... And, I mean, Vista, you know, poor Vista, man. But, I mean, you know, it was a solid try. Windows 7, those guys have really done amazing work, and they're using WAC GS.
Yes.
Right?
Oh, yes.
Probably WAC GS plus at some point.
Yes.
We can't speak for them, so let's continue.
Right.
But they definitely are using WAC GS, and they have a bunch of static analysis stuff, and they do a lot of great performance. And, I mean, the operating system has to not mess around with memory allocation speed, and it's a hungry system, right?
Yeah. And they're using WAC GS++, actually.
So. I bet they are. So, hey, you learned that first here on Channel 9.
That's right.
beautiful, man. It's always great to come talk to you. I mean, is there anything else that we missed? I mean, this has obviously kept you very busy.
Yeah. It's been fun, though.
It's great to have you, man. We'll come and talk to you again for GS Sharp.
Yeah.
Whatever you're working on.
Sounds good.
And who knows, maybe you'll find other things to do someday after 18 years. Great to see you, buddy.
Great to see you. Thank
Cheers.
You.